You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to the curator of the second largest collection of maps in the country, housed at UW-Milwaukee. First, a Green Bay native is facing a court-martial for his role in a deadly Navy crash. Commander Bryce Benson was the commanding officer of the USS Fitzgerald, which collided with a commercial vessel off the coast of Japan last year. The crash caused multiple deaths and was one of a string of mishaps that got national attention last summer, leading the Navy to temporarily suspend ship operations around the world. Eric Litke is an investigative reporter for USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's been following this story. With us now to talk about it, Eric, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
Well, talk to us about the person at the center of this story, Commander Bryce Benson.
So Benson is a Green Bay native, went to school in the Madison area, graduated from Marquette, and went on to a pretty lengthy career in the Navy. His first ship assignment as a commanding officer was the USS Fitzgerald. He was just about a month into his tenure when that had a deadly collision. That was last June in the waters of Asia. He was asleep in his bunk. This is during the middle of the night. It was moving through a very heavily trafficked shipping channel. And due to a variety of mistakes, the Navy reports on this say there were not proper lookouts posted, there was not proper training on radar, there was not proper transmitting so that the ship was telling other ships where it was. But a variety of factors that the Navy terms avoidable, the Fitzgerald collided with a container ship out of the Philippines, actually struck right outside of Benson's cabin. So he himself was significantly injured, had a traumatic head injury that he is still trying to recover from. And there's a series of investigations in the wake of that. And Benson now facing a court-martial, looks like, for his role in that as the Navy is deciding on who exactly to all hold accountable for this.
And multiple people died in this crash, correct?
Yes, yeah, seven sailors died. And again, experts say that a big part of this was there was no alarm sounded before the collision. So the large number of sailors were simply asleep in bunks, and that is unfortunately where the impact happened. So those sleeping areas flooded very, very quickly. Seven sailors were not able to make it out in time.
Let's look at the charges against Commander Benson. Some of the most recent news is that he was facing a charge of negligent homicide. It looks like that is not happening. Is that right?
Right. So there's kind of a few different steps in the process where they can kind of reconsider and decide what charges he's going to be looking at. So the initial charging decision by the admiral who's imposing discipline here did include negligent homicide. Now that he's actually being referred to the full general court-martial, they've amended that. The negligent homicide charge is gone. So he's facing two counts of negligent dereliction of duty resulting in death and one count of negligent hazarding of a vessel, basically negligent navigation.
Why is he getting this personal responsibility and liability? You mentioned he was off shift to the extent that a Navy commander can be. He was sleeping at the time of the incident?
Right. So the Navy tradition is basically whatever happens on the ship is the captain's responsibility. So ultimately, these shortfalls in training and in execution by the officers who were on duty, from the Navy's perspective, do fall squarely on Benson's shoulders. That it was on him to create an atmosphere where they were comfortable waking him up. There is a policy that if there's basically going to be close calls, ships in the area, the captain is supposed to be woken up so he can physically be on deck and be in charge. One of the officers who was on deck, though, says there was basically an unspoken culture on the ship to not follow that order in this area because it would have meant waking the captain up every 5 minutes. His attorney disputes that, but that's one of the things that we're really going to see kind of sorted out at this court-martial is how much is this, theoretically the correct orders and training could have been given and not followed, or was there a lack of training? There's also a really larger issue of what kind of situation the Navy was putting this ship and others like it in. So going back 2 years, the Government Accountability Office had produced a report at the request of Congress. This is a nonpartisan watchdog agency that really detailed the risks from ships like the Fitzgerald that are based overseas. It was based out of Japan. And the report 2 years ago said that shortfalls in training, reductions in maintenance, and a surge in deployed time was basically creating kind of this critical mass of risk that, something bad is going to happen. We find out in congressional hearings later that that report never even made it to the top levels of the Navy. The top folks in charge didn't read it. And tragically, that report was absolutely right on the money. In addition to the Fitzgerald, there were three other mishaps, a couple of collisions and a grounding, all in this area of Asia, ships deployed overseas in an eight-month span that claimed a total of 17 U.S. lives.
Talking to Eric Litke, investigative reporter for USA Today Network Wisconsin, looking at charges against Commander Bryce Benson of the U.S. Navy from Wisconsin himself. Let's dig a little more into some of the previous reviews. The Fitzgerald, the ship that Commander Benson was in charge of, in reviews, it had scored poorly way before he had been on board that ship, right?
So obviously it's difficult to know how much of this is supposed to be on him when he had only been in charge for a month. But, for example, the one of the audits the Navy did found that the Fitzgerald's training was out of date in 15 of 22 key areas that the Navy tracks, which included areas like communication and seamanship, which obviously were critical and central to the accident that happened.
Is it common for an individual commander in an accident like this to face charges as serious as a court-martial?
It is extremely, extremely unusual. Over the last 40 years or so, according to the Navy and historians we talked to, there's really only been two commanders that have faced a court-martial, and both of those were basically like a sexual misconduct type incident. You got to go back more than 30 years to find a Navy commander who was court-martialed for decisions they made in command of their vessels. So there is clearly, from the Navy's perspective, something that is different about this, and it'll certainly be interesting to see what additional details come out as we get to hear the testimony at that court-martial down the road.
What possible consequences does Commander Benson face from this court-martial?
It really runs the gamut. There is a possibility, technically, for time behind bars in the brig. Somewhere around 2 years would be the likely maximum there. But experts we talked to said that's pretty unlikely for this type of scenario where we're talking about negligence as opposed to willful misconduct. So more likely it's the kind of thing, again, according to the folks well-versed in these Navy law matters, that, you know, he could face a loss of pay and basically have a forced retirement, something along those lines.
What's the time scale? When does this get resolved?
That we don't know for sure yet. The Navy has not yet scheduled when the actual court-martial is going to happen.
What are we hearing from Commander Benson's legal representation? What's their argument on this?
We know he's stationed out of Washington right now and continuing to recover. In terms of the legal argument, basically, it does sound like they're going to be making some references to whether he was put in a position to succeed, you know, how much of a strain basically the demands on this fleet put in there, and then how much of the blame really needs to be apportioned to those under him as opposed to on him directly. So the comments we've gotten from his attorney have not gotten into that in great detail. But those are kind of the couple of main areas that you would expect them to tackle.
Seems like there are two different stories you could tell here. One, it's Commander Benson's fault. He had let discipline lapse on the ship, didn't follow orders, didn't follow procedures, including waking him up when he's in traffic. The other narrative could be we have this multi-year training problem in the Navy, shortfalls on this ship in particular, and this guy, 1 month on board, is a scapegoat for this. This is a really fundamental argument, isn't it?
It is, and it will certainly be interesting to see how this shakes out at a court-martial because there is certainly an argument to be made for both of those.
We'll leave it there and watch this along with you. Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Eric Litke, investigative reporter for USA Today Network Wisconsin, with us to talk about charges against a Green Bay native after a fatal Navy collision last year. First, UW-Milwaukee is celebrating the 40th anniversary of the American Geographical Society Library coming to the school. The collection, made up of more than 1.3 million items, including maps, atlases, and books, is the second largest collection of maps in the country. Materials include a map showing what a European mapmaker thought the world looked like back in 1452, along with charts signed and used by aviator Charles Lindbergh. Marcy Bidney is the Assistant Director of Libraries at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She's also the curator of the American Geographical Society Library. Marcy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Well, how did this collection come to be housed at UW-Milwaukee?
It's a long story, but I'm going to try to give you the short version. The short version being that the American Geographical Society, which is a professional organization that still exists today, built this really fantastic collection starting in 1852. And just about in the late 1960s, early 1970s, they understood that they weren't going to be able to provide a proper house for it anymore. And so they did a national search for a place to relocate the entire library. UWM put their name in the hat for the running to be the place for the library to come. And we won, I guess, yeah.
So well over a million items in this collection. Can you give us a sense of the range of what's in there?
We have approximately somewhere around 550,000 maps in the collection, somewhere on the verge of 625,000 images in our photo collection. And then the rest of the bulk of the collection is made up of atlases, globes. We've got about 220 globes, books, journals, and all covering a variety of topics related to geography, travel and exploration, history of cartography, history of science, history of photography, you name it, we've got it.
And this goes back hundreds and hundreds of years, spans the globe, and has lots of local material in it too, right?
Correct.
So talk about, let's start at the old end. We've got a 1452 map of the, well, I guess the known world at the time, known from Europe. Can you talk about the oldest part of the collection?
Yeah, it's so the oldest piece, you're right, is from 1452. It is a map of the world. And though we're on radio, I can describe that when you're looking at this map of the world, it doesn't really look like a map of the world as we are used to seeing maps of the world today. It was done by a cartographer named Giovanni Liardo, who was Venetian. And there are three of his maps left in the world, and we've got one of them. The other two live in libraries in Italy, in northern Italy. It's a beautiful map. It's more than 500 years old. It's in incredibly good condition. We have it framed in the collection, and anybody who wants to come into the library to take a look at it is welcome to do so.
Yeah, can you talk about, I want to talk about research in a minute, but for the public, I assume we can't go paw through the entire collection ourselves, but what kind of stuff could we see there?
You can't come in necessarily, like you said, paw through the collection, but we encourage the public to come in to use the collection. We are a public institution, so funded by the state of Wisconsin, so we are open to the public, and a lot of people come to use the collection for genealogy research. We host researchers from universities from around the world to come to the collection to do their research on whatever topic they are researching, and you can come in if you're looking for a map of a particular place. You can come and say, hey, I'd like to see a map of Warsaw, Poland, and we will pull out some maps of Warsaw, Poland, and you can take a look at them.
I understand. I hadn't heard of these. We did an interview with somebody who talked about researching old buildings as part of genealogy often, and there are these fire insurance company maps.
Yeah.
They kept really good maps, and you've got a lot of them. What kind of things do you have, and what do people do with those?
Yeah, so the Sanborn fire insurance maps are a really important piece of our collection, particularly for Milwaukee history. We have the Milwaukee Sanborn maps from the mid-1800s up through the early 1900s. And the Sanborn Fire Insurance Company is exactly what it sounds like. It was a fire insurance company. So if you are a fire insurance company, you provide fire insurance. And so what you need to know is a lot of information about the buildings in a particular place. You need to know what they're made out of, how tall they are, where there are windows, where there are doors. Are there other sorts of exits like a balcony with some steps? You need to know what's happening in that particular building. Is it a residential building? Is it some sort of manufacturing? Is it a store? And so the Sanborn company mapped towns across the United States at this level of detail and over time. So they're really important for people doing genealogy because we can see who, in many cases, see who lived at a particular address. We can see where manufacturing was in early Milwaukee. We can see they're fun to look at because we can see certain older parts of the city where things have been torn down and rebuilt over, and you can see that. One of our graduate students just created a web map, and you can find it on our website online, where the Sanborn maps, the old maps, are overlaid on what we call a web map, so sort of a Google map interface.
Oh, cool.
And you can search by address, and right now we only have the 1910 maps up, but you can search by address, and you can then use a slider to change the opacity of the maps, and you can see through the old map to the new web map and see what's there now and compare what used to be and what used to be in Milwaukee in 1910 and what is there now. And it's really a fantastic app. The other really important role it plays for Milwaukee history is it gives us the old street information. So in 1935, Milwaukee changed a lot of their street names, and it's always a challenge when you're doing historical research for the city, because you have to remember that that happened. And then you have to do some kind of translation like, this place used to be this on this street, and now it's this street. And so you have to kind of remember that. And having it online as a web map is a really great way for everybody in Milwaukee to be able to figure those things out more easily.
Talking to Marcy Bidney with the UW-Milwaukee Libraries, curator of the American Geographical Society Library, this huge collection of maps, atlases, images, and more. Marcy, a lot of this is online. I was just poking around, and it could get dangerous. I almost spent too much time poking around on the digital collection. Can you talk about what's up there?
We have a range of items available in our digital collection, and we're adding to it on a daily basis. We have, I think, around 10 to 12,000 maps uploaded into our digital collections, and we don't have a particular focus as far as the map collection is concerned. We try to do a range of places around the world. If there's some hot topic going on in the world and we have maps that are related to that particular topic, we'll try to get them up. And then the bulk of our digital collections really is our photographs. And mainly because our photograph collection isn't actually print photographs. It's really the film negatives. So in order to make them usable as images, we have to digitize them so that then we can have actual, like we can see what the image is without having to use a nitrate negative or a glass plate negative. So in the early 2000s, we had some grant funding from the National Endowment for the Humanities that allowed us to digitize around 100,000 of those images. We have about 80,000 of them online, and ranging in time frames from the late 1800s up through, I'd probably say, like about the 1970s right now. And we're also adding photos to the digital collections on a daily basis.
Now, Marcy, this is probably a really unfair question, but do you have a favorite map or series of maps in the collection?
It is an unfair question, but I get asked that question all the time. And we try not to have favorites, but it's really difficult. And it's actually really difficult to have favorites because there are so many maps in the collection, so to pick one is really difficult. But for the last couple of years, I do have one set of maps, actually, that is my favorite. And it's a set of what we call wind and current charts, and it sounds totally unsexy as far as maps are concerned. But the maps show the wind and current directions on the oceans around the world. And they're my favorite because they were made in the 1850s, and it was the first time that that information was visualized. And they were created by a cartographer, naval guy, oceanographer named Matthew Fontaine Maury. And he gathered the data by reading through thousands of naval ship logs. So just read, recorded the information, and then mapped it. And he did all of that with his brain and some paper without a computer and made some really fantastic maps. And it really contributed to improving navigation around the world. And particularly, it cut the sailing time across the Atlantic in half.
Wow.
Yeah, because the sailors were, you know, they always had a general idea of where the wind and currents were, but when you can be exact and know where you're going to pick it up and what season the wind is going to blow in a particular direction, you can hop on that current real fast, and it's going to speed up your time across the ocean. So they're really just a fascinating set of maps. And I think for me, it's really the science behind them that keeps me going back and looking at them and just being amazed.
Well, and very briefly, that sense of historical connection with the person on the other end of the map, the person who made it.
Yeah, right. And he was a pretty incredible guy. He's also considered the father of oceanography, so really started the study of the oceans around the world. So really a fantastically interesting human being.
We'll leave it there. Marcy, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
That's Marcy Bidney, Assistant Director of Libraries at UW-Milwaukee, also Curator of the American Geographical Society Library, the second largest collection of maps in the country, housed at UW-Milwaukee. Now, President Trump tweeted this weekend that he wants undocumented immigrants to be deported immediately without getting judges or courts involved. His statement on Twitter read in part, quoting now, "We cannot allow all of these people to invade our country. When somebody comes in, we must immediately, with no judges or court cases, bring them back from where they came. Our system is a mockery to good immigration policy and law and order," end quote. While the president didn't mention due process explicitly, his call to end that guiding principle for millions of people in the United States would be a departure from previous presidents. And legal experts have raised constitutional concerns pointing to past Supreme Court rulings. The statements come in the midst of controversy over what the administration describes as a zero-tolerance policy at the U.S. border. Elise Cohen is an assistant professor of political science at UW-Sheboygan and UW-Manitowoc. Elise, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Glad to be here.
Well, this gets complicated pretty quickly, but can you talk about the concept of due process and how it applies to people coming to the United States without official documents?
Yeah, so what we're seeing now is that this series of tweets from President Trump is coming on the heels of some of these other moves, part of a crackdown or getting tough on illegal immigration approach of his administration. So I think a lot of the shock or surprise really needs to be understood in the context of the zero tolerance policy, again, to sort of criminally prosecute all irregular entries. Second, the subsequent separation of families that we've been hearing a lot about, and that we also just saw a new executive order address last week. Some other moves, like Attorney General Sessions' move to disqualify domestic violence, gang violence from eligibility to get asylum. So I think this is sort of understood by those that oppose it as something coming on the heels of these other moves against protection for migrants, asylum seekers, maybe even, you know, tenets of democracy. And for those that support it, sort of seeing it as a broader pattern of efforts to get tough and crack down and really defend U.S. sovereignty and border defense. The due process questions are surrounding the constitutional issues of, you know, whether migrants have protections afforded to them in some of the same ways that U.S. citizens have under the Constitution. So especially the Fifth Amendment and the 14th Amendment are two provisions where we see the Constitution does say that people should not be deprived of life or liberty without due process under the law.
Does that, a lot of the objections to concerns about due process say, well, that applies to citizens, not people here illegally. Is that true?
Right. So this is where you've heard a lot of debate and discussion. Whether these constitutional provisions apply to immigrants has been settled by a lot of previous legal precedents and court rulings, because so many of those provisions in our constitutional language don't refer just to citizens, but they actually refer to persons. And there have been rulings affirming that, indeed, you know, immigrants, even if they're unlawful or undocumented, they are people, they are persons. So the Fifth Amendment that I mentioned and the 14th Amendment, both often coming into the conversation on due process, not being deprived of, again, life, liberty, or property without due process under the law. It says persons in both of those constitutional provisions. So as long as you are on U.S. soil or somehow in U.S. jurisdiction, then those constitutional protections should, in theory, apply. The issue that we can see some complication come out of is in the practice of it, where we see that the immigration courts are their own separate court system that have really lacked a lot of the typical protections that regular citizens would have in the ordinary courts. And that's where we see some ambiguity over exactly what the due process protections mean when we talk about undocumented immigrants in those immigration courts.
Now, for the bulk of people who have entered, as you say, irregularly, they're in this backed-up system, what due process rights have they had in practice?
Right. So the right to have some counsel is probably the area where we see the most complexity, because this is something that the Sixth Amendment actually says, you know, a right to legal counsel for all criminal prosecutions. And now a lot of people may be familiar with the notion that if you're very poor or cannot afford counsel, you could have an attorney provided to you. Where we see some complication with that is that the courts have ruled that right to counsel is for criminal prosecutions. And a lot of times the immigration courts and something like unlawful entry has been viewed as a civil rather than a criminal type of case. And so the right to legal counsel has not really applied to those undocumented migrants in the immigration courts. What's interesting is with the new zero tolerance policy, if the administration really pursues criminal prosecution charges for all of those, there's some discussion about, well, then would that kind of bring up this idea that those undocumented migrants would have a right to legal counsel. Again, we see going back and forth some challenges because there have been rulings that make it seem like it's mostly for felonies. And if someone is crossing irregularly for the first offense, that is only a misdemeanor, not a felony. So the right to counsel is probably the one where we see the most debate.
Talking to Elise Cohen, Assistant Professor of Political Science at UW-Sheboygan and UW-Manitowoc, looking at the rights of people entering the United States illegally, and tweets from the president suggesting that there should be changes, taking away various elements of due process. And the president has talked, Elise, specifically about immigration judges. We've heard a lot of calls for hiring more immigration judges to get through a backlog. The president saying in this tweet anyway, no, not judges. He's been saying in speeches, we don't need immigration judges. This shouldn't even go to a judge. People should just be turned out without a review by a judge. Do I have that right?
Yes, and this is a really interesting move. I think, as I said at the beginning of the program, it makes sense for those that support the policy as part of a kind of crackdown, this idea that we're going to be tougher than any previous administrations have ever been. For those that are more critical of it, and especially those, I think, in the advocacy arena and sort of the immigration, human rights areas that have been studying or working in these fields, they see this as a move further away from something that has already been a problem for a long time, which is this notion that the U.S. has already been depriving a lot of the constitutional rights that should, in theory, be afforded to undocumented migrants. And we haven't been doing a good job, in part because our immigration court system is a separate court system, and those immigration judges have very few resources. It's kind of a high-stakes, high-volume court system where, you know, the judges may have to make a decision tantamount to a death penalty case, because if the asylum seeker is sent back to the territory, they may face torture or death. And the immigration judge often has a very limited window to make that call and doesn't have the amount of resources, clerical staff, et cetera, that our normal court system has. So it has been backlogged for some time, and there have been really serious concerns, human rights and legal concerns, about what that means for people that have to go through and are sort of pushed through the system so quickly. What the administration is saying now is we want to push it through even faster. I think one of the things that's getting a lot of attention from within the immigration judges' realm is this idea that their performance evaluations will be tied to their completion of tighter deadlines. And they've even issued some, letters kind of collectively saying there's no way, we are so overwhelmed as it is, and if we are forced to make even quicker determinations on these really high-stakes asylum decisions, we will absolutely be violating the basic rights and legal protections of the system.
A concern I've seen raised, at least by some people, is that if there's no due process, no review, even by a judge, it's possible that people with some kind of legal status in the United States, whether a work visa, a student visa, maybe even a citizen, if they're apprehended under the impression that they're here illegally, they might not have a venue to prove that they have legal status here.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Rob. One of the things that the immigration judge is tasked with is, first of all, determining if that person that's come before them is a citizen. That can be more complicated than it sounds on the surface, because it can be about more than just proof of birthplace and the documentation involved in that. We also offer a sort of jus sanguinis, or citizenship by blood. So there may be, some parental considerations to also figure out. Establishing whether that person is a citizen itself takes time. And when these immigration judges have already been seeing, just maybe like 60 cases or something like that in a couple of hours that they have to address, the idea of pushing them to consider even more at a faster pace is what really has them feeling quite overwhelmed. We also saw under the Obama administration, actually, that when he had the Secure Communities program in 2011, that was a problem with it. We were deporting a lot of people, actually thousands of people, that ended up being citizens, but we were deporting them in such a rapid manner that they sort of got lost in the shuffle. And so we were sending people out that were legally citizens.
We're talking to Elise Cohen, Assistant Professor of Political Science at UW-Sheboygan and UW-Manitowoc. We're talking about President Trump's call to effectively end due process for undocumented immigrants in the United States. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the president's call for changes, reducing the role of judges in immigration cases, turning people away more quickly? Agree, disagree? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about President Trump's call to effectively end due process for many undocumented immigrants. Elise Cohen is with us, Assistant Professor of Political Science at UW-Sheboygan and UW-Manitowoc. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your reactions to this and other recent incidents in the immigration debate. Do you agree or disagree with the course the president is taking? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. To your calls we go. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. A lot of the funding for the cartels and the violence in South America, Central America, Mexico comes from the United States drug use. I was wondering if the United States drug use and its funding for all this violence changes the constitutionality or the legal arguments, because we're in fact promoting the violence from where these illegal immigrants are coming from, so to speak. Thanks so much.
Charlie, thanks for the call. Elise, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point that your caller raises. I think kind of getting at this idea of maybe some U.S. culpability or some U.S. responsibility regarding the flows of people that are coming in. We do know that a lot of the migrants along the southern and southwestern border are being driven by the high levels of war, violence, and conflict, especially in those northern triangle countries, Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador. And we know that something like 90% of the documented cocaine flows into the United States pass through those three northern triangle countries. And there's this really fascinating and long history of U.S. foreign policy in the region, U.S. decisions about drug interdiction and deportation that contributed to a lot of this violence. So I think the caller's point about addressing the sort of root cause of the violence has been raised by a lot of people. Can we maybe have a discussion or some more attention among lawmakers to the pull effects that we see from the demand that our citizens have for these drugs?
President Trump was asked about his thoughts on the U.S. immigration system at an Oval Office meeting yesterday with the King of Jordan. Here's some what he had to say.
We want a system where when people come in illegally, they have to go out. And a nice, simple system that works. You know, Mexico holds people for 4 hours, for 5 hours, for 2 hours, and they're gone. We have people for 4, 5, 6 years, and they never leave. So we want to have a great immigration. What we have is very simple. We want strong borders, and we want no crime.
Elise, can it be that simple?
Yeah, I think that's a really useful clip that we played because I think the frames that are involved in this debate really reveal a lot about our partisan divisions right now in this country over the immigration issues. So I loved that we could hear some of that in the clip that you played where President Trump is saying things like, you know, defending our sovereignty through strong borders. You mentioned at the beginning of the program his tweet from early in the week where he said that there was an immigrant invasion. So this idea of strong borders, the threat of invasion, no crime, so kind of we're going to be tough on crime. These are some of the broader themes that we see in polling data and surveys of, you know, Republicans versus Democrats, how they have sort of opposing policy values. So for Republicans and a lot of Trump supporters, he really is hitting on the values that they prioritize. For Democrats or political liberals, they may be more concerned with some of those due process issues because they fit into concepts of human rights and this idea of fairness and compassion. So some of the research on what divides Republicans and Democrats and conservatives and liberals, I think, shows us why that language matters so much and why he would use those kinds of words.
Go back to our callers now. Jesse is with us in Walworth. Jesse, hi.
Yeah, hello.
Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yep, go ahead, Jesse.
Yes. Well, I just want to say that having gone through the system of immigration, in the last 35, 40 years, it has changed. There's really not a problem with it other than they need more personnel to work and do all the things they need to do. The law is fine. But unfortunately, they have been using this as a political issue to do or not to do something or say this or say that. But what they really need is more personnel to process everything that they have to process. Now, like I said, having gone through this system, I know that a system, the laws, and everything is fine. Now, as far as deporting people, everybody has or should have the right to have a hearing. There's many persons that have been deported, and within a month or 2 months, or even weeks, a couple weeks, they're killed.
I want to jump in, Jesse, because you gave us a lot to talk about there. First of all, he's saying he's okay, having been through the system with how it works, but not enough personnel. And we're seeing, I think, Senator Ron Johnson from Wisconsin saying, hey, we need more immigration judges. People talk about needing more everywhere in the system. Is he right, Elise?
Yeah, absolutely. For the immigration courts, we hear the same thing coming from the immigration judges themselves. And when they've made attempts to, you know, strike collective bargaining agreements or something like that, just how overwhelmed they are with their caseload. I saw a really interesting study the other day that said immigration judges and surveys of stress level ranked higher for how much work stress they face than even really busy hospital doctors or prison wardens. So the amount of work that's being put onto a very limited number of judges to hear so many cases in such a short window of time does get to this need for more resources. Another thing that the caller brought up was this idea that, you know, everybody has the right to have a hearing. We've seen some changes that predated the Trump administration. Something called expedited removal has been in effect for a while. So what's interesting is that that's been heavily critiqued, that we already had from the late 1990s a law passed by Congress that said some people can just be sent back right away without having any hearing before an immigration judge at all. And so that's an area where we've seen a lot of calls to do reform, that we're falling out of line with international law and human rights norms because we allow for these, quote, expedited removals. So the current plan to have even more expedited removals, again, is not something that we haven't already been doing. It's something that we've been doing and we've been criticized for. So the idea is we may do it even more.
Thanks for that call. Jesse, we'll go next to Mark in Milwaukee. Mark, hi.
Hi. I am against the restrictions, and I had a question for the professor. I read an article, I think it was in the journal yesterday, about presently the due process rights do not extend to people within a certain distance over the border into the United States, and there was some kind of a time frame restriction as well. And I was wondering if the professor could clarify that a little bit.
Thanks for the call, Mark. Elise, do you know about that?
Yeah, that's actually a really nice tie-in to the idea of the expedited removal. I think what your caller is referencing is the expedited removal kind of defined what the border is as being anything 100 miles from within the territorial border. And that can be either the southern border with Mexico or that can be our northern border with Canada. If the individual is apprehended within 100 miles of the border or a sort of major port of authority, or if it's something like they've been here less than 2 weeks, that was the original expedited removal law, is that for some of those people, immigration, really low-level immigration officers, could just make a call to immediately deport them without any hearing or any real due process rights to speak of. What the current administration is proposing is not only expanding the number of those expedited removals, but expanding the time frame from it has to be within 2 weeks that they were apprehended for illegally crossing, up to it can be within 2 years. So really, you know, making that time window much broader.
And very briefly, thanks, Mark, for that call. Are these things that the president can do on his own, or does Congress need to weigh in, just in our last few moments?
Yeah, that's a really great final point. I think we see about half of the really restrictionist policies on immigration have come from Congress, but we've also had really big controversial moves come from just executive orders, like orders directly from the president to detain people, like Japanese internment, for example, or Jimmy Carter banning Iranian immigration after the hostage crisis. So it's kind of a mix, and the president does have a lot of discretion.
Elise, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
That's Elise Cohen, Assistant Professor of Political Science at UW-Sheboygan and UW-Manitowoc.